This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 237 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along. To find out more and how to participate, visit outlanderpod.com/DOA.
What is Beachbody On Demand? Beachbody On Demand is an online fitness streaming service that gives you unlimited access to a wide variety of highly effective, world-class workouts personalized to meet your needs.
And they also have extensive nutritional content. And with Beachbody On Demand, it's the total package to help you become the total package. You may have heard of some of their brands, Pio, P90X, Insanity, 21 Day Fix. There's a lot to offer. You will not get bored.
No, there's content for days. I know that I personally have been enjoying doing some country line dancing workouts. They make me feel like I'm not working out.
I thought you were going to say they make me feel like a natural woman. Well, either way, I'm still sticking to the for now 10 minute.
If you're going to do now you feel like a natural woman, this was not an Aretha Franklin line dancing. This was a country line dancing show. It should have been a man. I feel like a woman, which would have been a Shania Twain reference, which would have been funnier than what you threw at me. But go ahead.
So Summer likes line dancing. I go back and forth between the 10 minute one and the 21 day fix, because the 21 day fix, even though I mean, it's for 21 days, I currently do not use the nutrition guidelines, although it has its own, but I do love the workouts and it's just enough variation. It's different. It's 7 days and I'm good.
Well, and the best thing is if you've been doing it for 7 days and you're bored, guess what? Try another one. There's so many more to try.
Was your New Year's resolution to get in shape? Did you keep it? Why not let Beachbody On Demand help you help yourself out?
You need to give this service a try. And right now, our listeners can get a free trial membership when you text Outlander to 303030.
You will get full access to this entire platform for free. All the workouts and nutrition information free. Just text Outlander to 303030.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be discussing Chapter 13. Good God, Chapter 13. An examination of conscience. And it's not only an examination in conscience, it's an examination in how long it took Davina to read 44 pages.
This chapter should also be named The One That Killed Davina.
Oh, good Lord. There's no way she did that in one take.
Well, she doesn't.
It took 2 hours, y'all. 2 hours.
And that's the final product.
Yeah.
This chapter is extraordinarily full. Leanne F. writes, the chapter continues the theme of seeing America as a chance for a new start, a fresh Garden of Eden, and a blank slate for Jamie and Claire to make their own choices about how they want to live their lives. Old demands of family loyalties and responsibilities, however, set up amoral dilemmas for Jay and C, Jamie and Claire, to ponder and maneuver. If Jamie agrees to be the heir to River Run, Jamie and Claire must confront the serpent in the garden, slavery. Now, this is... the reason I'm reading this up front is because it was like a kind of summary of the chapter, so I'm putting it up front. So all of this we will get to. How could Jamie and Claire ever be comfortable as slaveholders? Even as heir to Jocasta, Jamie would still find himself a pawn of his aunt's as she makes her next manipulative move, all of which goes to show that 20 years and thousands of miles have not erased what they experienced back in Scotland. Okay, then. The chapter opens with... it's raining frogs. Hallelujah. It's raining frogs. No, okay, men. What significance does frogs have? Something maybe like one of the biblical plagues. That's the only thing I could think of. Jamie thinks that they're singing. Of course, we know Jamie can't hear a ding-dong thing. He's tone-deaf and he owns it. Through Davina, Jamie quotes, brekekekex coax coax brekekekex coax. That has to be from something. I don't know what it's from. No, I did not look it up. If you guys know, I'm happy to know. Claire is still high on adrenaline from the balls. From the ball they attended. Claire is still...
Aren't we all?
Well, she did actually attend to a ball. Claire is still high on adrenaline from the ball surgery, plus alcohol.
But mostly the balls.
Ball surgery, yes. They sit on the bench, on a bench near the dock. So he is taking Claire outside to get some air. That's how the last chapter ended. He's like, we got to talk. He's had quite an evening too. He says, he tells Claire, Jocasta had planned to make an announcement at dinner that night to tell everyone that she meant to make him her heir. To everything. House, fields, orchards, gardens, stables, forests, sawmill, and the 40 slaves. And everything on there. On there, in there, around there. And she'd meant it to be a dramatic unveiling. Jamie in Hector's tartan, surrounded by Hector's old colleagues and friends. If this had happened in the company of loyal Scots, it would have been done. That's it. He would have been anointed by all. Jamie admits that he would have found it very difficult to decline had it been, public and done. Eileen P. writes, Claire really nailed it. Jocasta's plan to make Jamie her heir by springing it on him at a dinner party was thoroughly Mackenzian. She is made of the same stuff as her brothers, Colm and Dougal, and sees nothing wrong with using Jamie to meet her own needs. While I do acknowledge she is trying to protect her power, a power that is scarce for women in that time period, she could have discussed it with Jamie in private rather than trying to force his hand in public. So Jamie is telling Claire why he wanted the diversion. Now we understand the conundrum. Sort of. Jamie is still wrestling with it, even though hasn't formally happened yet. He's mulling it over. If it were a simple thank you, no, he'd have no qualms about rejecting it. But it's stuck. Ulysses is the de facto master of River Run, and Jamie has checked the accounts. He's done a pretty good job, Ulysses has. But Jamie isn't sure Ulysses would like giving up that work. Quote, I'm sure he's an honest man and a faithful servant, but he wouldn't be human to welcome giving up his place to a stranger. Claire herself isn't 100% sure Jamie would say no. Quote, pride, caution, or both might have caused him to want to thwart Jocasta's plan, but that didn't mean he meant to reject her offer either. Unquote. His silence disturbs Claire. Quote, he didn't reply, and a small, cold chill ran through me. Unquote. They're having this discussion now as they walk through the orchard, pungent with the scent of ripening fruit, symbolic of imminent new life, birth. Whichever way Jamie decides, to take Jocasta's offer or to take up Tryon's, it will be a new beginning for them both. Claire imagines the taste of new apples and makes the comparison to temptation. Eden. Quote, and the worm that lay hidden beneath the shining skin. Unquote. Temptation for her, too. For Jamie, he had a chance to be what he was born to be. A leader of men, a laird of a large estate, to lead, to care, to direct, to steward. Quote, more importantly, the restoration of clan and family. Unquote. Claire makes a good point, one I hadn't ever considered. Jamie didn't care for wealth or power. Quote, if he did, knowing what I knew about the future's shape, he would have chosen to go north to seek a place among the founders of a nation. Unquote. Did you ever, I mean, I've read this before, but that never hit me like this before. She's right. Could you imagine Jamie, like James Fraser, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence? I mean, obviously not in real life, but even being around those founding fathers, wouldn't that, that would have been a different book, huh?
Well, then Hamilton the musical would have been a little different too.
I was just about to say, but see, this is you did it, not me.
I did it to trump you. I knew you wanted to say it.
Trump me. No, I was leaving it out because you don't like me mentioning it.
Of course I don't.
Actually, I don't know. You may not like me mentioning it, but I don't think you really care. I think you really care if I sing.
That is the truth.
Jamie had even been a leader of men while in prison. Quote, they were mine, and the having of them kept me alive. Unquote. Jamie needed people to care for, men to lead. but not to own. While Claire viewed River Run as a paradise and an opportunity, she can't constitute owning another human. Quote, I had called a black man friend and left my daughter in his care, unquote. We get a flash of Joe Abernathy and Rihanna. It jostles Claire a bit. Her temptation has always been Jamie. It had called her away from her daughter. If Jamie didn't take on River Run, he would likely take on Tryon's offer. And if he lived, he would have something to leave for Brianna. Eileen P. writes, to become an heir of a plantation or a pioneer settling in the wild. That is Jamie's dilemma. As heir to River Run, he would be taking Jocasta's orders and upon inheriting it, be a slave owner. He would also become the laird he was born to be. As a pioneer, could he establish a settlement in untamed mountains? It's more of a risk given the danger in building it from scratch. Plus, he would be beholden to Governor Tryon by serving in the militia. On top of this, Jamie expresses his burden of bearing the responsibility of others. It's easier to take a risk when it's just you that will suffer the consequences. I liked that Jamie and Claire discussed this as a couple. They listen to each other. Claire can't make Jamie's decision for him. Jamie will not put that burden on her. However, he will take who she is into account. He knows his wife and what she can bear. Being a slave owner is not one of them. Time to explore the wilderness? Luckily, Claire was brought up by an anthropologist who is used to roughing it. Makes me think, what did Uncle Lamb know? Oh my gosh. Okay.
Okay. That's not the only reason she's used to roughing it. Even if it weren't for that, she did spend how many years on campaign with him during the Jacobite uprising, living real rough?
Not years. I don't know when they exactly went back to France, but so April of 1746, she left and he went off to die. And she was probably a few months pregnant. At least 2 months pregnant by then. Well, they spent some time in Edinburgh, right? At the court, at the then court of Bonnie Prince Charlie. Yeah, but it probably was a few months. It started in 75, but not like January 1st. But yeah, I mean, I would give it a few months. So definitely a few months.
I mean, it was long enough that she was visibly starved.
Yeah.
Oh, like
yeah.
Her body was becoming, you know, less curvy and they were... You know, everyone was suffering a little bit from malnutrition. So, I mean, it's like it was not short. There was time spent.
Well, okay. She was only back there for barely 3 years or almost 3 years. So it wasn't a year or anything, but it could have absolutely been more than a few months, which in rough enough conditions, that's enough to get you malnourished, I think. Claire is tempted by Jamie. She even wants to take him here and now in the fragrant floral border. Claire is earthy. Always has been. She also flashes to the tombstone with his name. The one that is in Scotland that we did not get in the series. So I guess that's not a thing. Or won't be a thing. Their walk had taken them in a complete circle. And so they now are back to the beginning. The decision to be made. So that was very nice imagery. Of Diana. It's like, you know, they're talking things out, but a decision has not been made. And they're kind of, it's not that they haven't made any progress, but as far as the decision-making process is, they have made no progress because they are back at the beginning, right? You go around in a circle, you go 360 degrees, you end up right where you were. They put off the decision even more, or at least talking about it. They go out for a row. They wanted to get away from the house and Jocasta to clear their minds and think. As Claire steps down into the boat, Jamie pulls her to him and kisses her. And he says to her, quote, I don't know, unquote. While out on the river, he asks if she has no opinion. And she says it has to be his choice. All of this conversation is on the water. Remember the puddles that she was afraid of as a child and how she felt If she did fall through, she'd be able to hold on to one of the stars to save her. Jamie is often called the sun, and here she is in the water with her son. Her premonition was right. She is safe. He wants to know if she'll be a spectator, not participate, not share her opinion, if she'll leave, because the whole thing becomes too much for her, the owning of slaves. She says she can't. And then I wrote in parentheses, except she did for a hot second in Jamaica. But it was not of her own volition. She was not told of it beforehand. But it was her fault. We can say that. Jamie wants to know if she could stand staying there with him, with the slaves, knowing they weren't going to be freed as long as Jocasta lived. Jocasta was a little more than 60, so come on now. And she looked really good. And you know what? He may not have been able to free them afterwards. Quote, I suddenly saw what he meant. Could I bring myself to live? Day after day, month after month, year after year, as an owner of slaves. I could not pretend to be otherwise, could take no refuge in the notion that I was only a guest, an outsider. Unquote. If she did this, she would no longer be an outlander. And an owner may not free his slaves without the written permission of the assembly. Quote, the plantation owners go in fear of an armed insurrection, unquote, of former slaves. Slaves who are free are required to leave the colony that they're in within a certain period of time, or if they're captured, they can be re-enslaved. Yahoo! What a way to treat them! Gracious. Jamie knows that Jocasta would still be the master, were he to say yes to her offer. He would be her hands where she could not be. She needed a man, not a husband. Claire knows that she couldn't handle it, but she couldn't urge him to reject her offer either, for this, quote, would send him to Scotland to meet an unknown death, unquote. Now, I get that she was referring to that gravestone. Why would rejecting her offer automatically mean that he would be off to Scotland and die? So I did put some things together. So obviously, if I remember correctly, the only thing I could think of was if he rejects her offer and takes Tryon's, he has to go to Scotland to start recruiting people. Is that right?
Not necessarily, but I think that Jocasta's offer is an assured place indefinitely. You know what I mean? And there's no, they would have no direct reason to need to go back to Scotland in the near future. Like it then his having a headstone in Scotland, meaning he died either en route to or while in Scotland, is that much further off. Because if there's nothing keeping him in America, then, you know, there's nothing stopping him from going back.
That makes sense. But she can't say either way. About this time, Jamie docks their boat. And in another one of the quintessentially outlander lines, he says, quote, your face is my heart, Sassenach, and love of you is my soul, but you're right, you canna be my conscience, unquote. Jamie doesn't think he's as good as she thinks he is. Quote, you wouldn't hold me in the same estimation as, say, a man like Stephen Bonnet. He might well say he acted from necessity, unquote. The difference, Jamie says, is that he, Jamie, has a sense of honor that Bonnet lacks. So, Summer, what did you think about that discussion? I understand he's like being Debbie Downer kind of ish, but not really. Why would he even think? I understand being done on yourself, but why would he think that Claire would think that he's not that good?
He just said he doesn't think that Claire would think that, but he's stating that he doesn't think he is. And that's how I took that, because he's always taken on all the blame for all the things that ever happened to anyone in or around his charge. Mm-hmm. So there's so much we'll call it Catholic guilt. There's so much Catholic guilt going on with him that I think I think he has a skewed vision of himself. I think we all do, to be honest.
Of course.
But I don't know. I don't think he sees himself through the same lens that Claire does, and he can't imagine anyone not seeing him for who he thinks he is.
Mm-hmm. Or in the same way that he thinks he sees himself.
Yeah.
Eileen P. writes, interesting turn in the conversation between Jamie and Claire. Is Jamie a good man? Claire thinks he's the best. Jamie, however, sees the aspect of him that is violent. It doesn't matter how you rationalize that violence, it still leaves a mark on his soul. I think we should figure out how many commandments Jamie has broken. No matter how many or how justified and rationalized, Jamie does not feel good about it. He has a conscience and his deeds stay with him, making him a complex, empathetic human being.
Okay, so we have thou shalt not kill. He did that. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. He did that. But it wasn't his neighbor, but it was Frank, somebody else's wife.
Eva, someone else's soon-to-be wife.
Yeah, that's so twice then.
Although he didn't covet her. That was forced.
True. Well, he didn't covet her the first time. The second time was totally coveting. The rest of the evening was coveting.
Oh, I see. Mary McNabb.
Mary McNabb, but she was no one's wife at that point. I don't think, not gluttony. Definitely not sloth, I wouldn't say.
Those aren't commandments. Those are the seven deadly sins, but they're not commandments.
Oh. Well, that's not nearly as much fun. I don't remember all the commandments.
Me either. I should. Leanne F. writes, Jamie's moral character, best man Claire knows, sees him as honorable, just, protector of weaker against more powerful, and provider for all those who look to him as head of the family versus wicked man, the wicked man he thinks of himself as. Sees himself as a man of violence, a man who might have helped kill, this is a tiny bit ahead of things, but again, it's within the chapter. A man who might have helped kill Bobby Murchison, a thief when needed, like Bonnet, a descendant of both the old fox and the cunning Mackenzies. I love this one. Like, Jamie has a very modern lament. Quote, I am more than 45. A man should be settled at that age. No, he should have a house and some land to grow his food and a bit of money put away to see him through his old age, at the least. Unquote. Okay, dear listener, it's 2018. How many people, let's say between 35 and 45, have all of that? And if you do, I am so happy for you. This is like a 300-year-old problem.
It is a 300-year-old problem. However, let's also consider the fact that most men were dead by the time they reached 45. So for him to even be alive at 45, having gone through the trying times and in the locations that he was, the life expectancy was not that great. So he's considering himself based upon the time period on death's door. You know, he should be by all rights dead by now, right? So you would think that. So you would hope that at that point you would be more settled before you die.
Yeah. Leanne F. writes, but even he is blind at times to his own priceless qualities. And that is when Claire steps in and reminds us all that it doesn't matter in the slightest because he is the king of men. The most perfect example of this in this chapter occurs as Jamie arrives at his dark night of the soul when he despairs that he has nothing to call his own at the age of 45. Not even the clothes he has on, and would like to offer Claire the world. Both Jamie and Claire have to answer to their own consciences and cannot make these difficult decisions for one another. They have to agree, though, because they will both have to live with the consequences of the decision. Jamie's upset, but Claire reminds him, "You have me," unquote. Now that's the quandary. If it were only him, he could live like Myers in the backcountry. But it's Claire and Fergus and young Ian and Duncan and Marsali and their maybe Bairn. And, I mean, come on, Rollo. He says, quote, God help me, there's even Leary to think of. And she replies, oh, let's don't.
Exactly.
Oh, that made me laugh out loud as I read it. I was like, that's great. And he says, do you not understand? Quote, I would lay the world at your feet, Claire, and I have nothing to give you, unquote. And Diana writes, of Claire. He honestly thought it mattered. Unquote. Claire makes her choice. She begins the another biblical quote, or a biblical quote, quote, "Whither thou goest, I will go," etc. She says, "You do what you have to. I'll..."
You do you. You do you, Jamie.
"You do what you have to. I'll be there. I'll be there to protect you with an unselfish love."
Oh, Ginger. Ginger, come on. It's painful.
Megan P. writes, "I really enjoyed the start of this chapter because we find Jamie and Claire so in sync as they contemplate their options moving forward. They both believe in the same things and want the same things, even while being so different. The realities they face during this time in America are certainly crazy to think about from a modern point of view. As someone that lives in the South and loves it, it's pretty disheartening to have these realities in print before you and know them to be historically accurate. I'm glad that Jamie and Claire both agree this way of life is wrong. It is so relatable to read about Jamie wrestling with his life choices and what he has to show as a 45-year-old man. The burdens of a husband are so very real. As old-fashioned as this as it is with so many capable women being the breadwinners today, many men often feel as if the burdens of providing and supporting their spouse and progeny fall solely on their shoulders. In the time and place that Jamie finds himself in, he really is responsible for so many, and he feels the weight of this strongly. He's made very selfish choices when he was without Claire. I feel that Ian was right in this letter. In his letter, Claire is Jamie's starting and stopping point, his inner compass. Claire realized they weren't done with their wee jaunt. Jamie kept rowing and rowing further. And then they arrived at the mill. As she finds the atmosphere freaky, Jamie tells her that Burns is dead of tetanus, lockjaw, and it took him 5 days to die. Claire, the physician, knows it isn't a quick death and is upset, to say the least, that Jamie saw him and didn't tell her. No, she couldn't have saved him, but she might have eased his suffering a bit. But he wouldn't let Campbell send for her. And this is part of the reason Jamie had questioned whether or not he was a good man. Claire reminds us that Jamie was merciful once. Quote, "But the years between now and then had been hard ones, and compassion was a soft emotion, easily eroded by circumstance." But the real reason he didn't want her to come was actually, in true Jamie fashion, to protect her. After a mild standoff in their disagreement, he tells her he was wrong by not allowing her to show up, by not having her called. She reminds him of her oath. She says, "Yes, I would have had to go. I'm a doctor. Don't you see?"
I don't think he was wrong. I think he was 100% right.
I do too. And that's where we're going now. So then he tells her exactly why he was antsy about having her there. There had been talk about the slave dying in her arms at the mill. His point is he didn't think it a good idea for her to, quote, "preside over both deaths," unquote. Even if they both literally, well, one of them did, but even if they both, to the outsider, literally had nothing to do with her. It's too, it's just, it's maybe not 20 years ago in Cranesmere, but it's still 18th century, and it is just, she's almost been burned as a witch. She almost got killed in Paris. I mean, different reason, but you don't want to bring attention to yourself, Claire. And Jamie, I agree with you, Summer. I believe Jamie was right. He, rather than saying no, no, no for so long, he should have said, "Look, I was trying to protect you. I understand it was wrong to not, to basically keep you uninformed of everything," but he should have told her, you know, either just after it happened or, you know, at some point there was some kind of middle ground while keeping her safe and not allowing her to go there, but at least keeping her in the know.
Yeah, I think beating around the bush in this conversation just prolonged it. I think if he just from the get-go just said, "Look, B."
Look, see. I think... And no, I am not saying the bad word. I'm just saying she's Claire.
Just saying, instead of being like, you couldn't have helped him. I mean, all of the things he said were true. There's nothing you could have done for him. You know, all of those, you know, lockjaw, blah, blah, blah. What would you have been able to do? All those things were true. However, that's not the largest issue at hand and not the reason he didn't call her. The largest issue at hand is that the last thing she needs is more people thinking she's killing people because she's now the lady who shows up to doctor you and you die. So, I mean, it wouldn't be good for her reputation as a doctor being new to where she is. And definitely not a good reputation just as, you know, newcomers to the area, that all the people that you go and say that you're helping mysteriously die under your care.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is, I mean, there's nothing much to say. It's just that, I guess Claire hasn't learned. I mean, I think everyone respects her ethic and her oath and her compassion and her dedication. That's not in question, but I think she's so focused on it, and I get it because, you know, you're a healer. Your job is to heal where you can and give succor, you know, give whatever kind of, if not healing, then at least, I guess, company, right? Sit at the bedside of those who are ill and dying.
She can't see the forest for the trees.
Exactly. She, her heart and her mind and her spirit are in the right place. And that's kind of illustrating Diana's point and I don't have the exact thing memorized, but when he says, your face is my heart, the love of you is something. So basically another one of their like matchy-matchinesses or they're fulfilling each other is that she is his heart in a way, right? I don't know if he says he's her conscience. I don't think neither can be the other's conscience, but he basically, without making another one of those cutesy, beautiful sayings like, you're my heart. And she's like, you're my blank. No, without saying that, Diana shows in this exchange why they freaking need each other. Because she's not going to look out for her own best interest when it comes to a patient. That's all. Chapter's done. I'm just kidding.
No,
oh, you
not.
Wish. Okay.
You are barely like 10 minutes into the 2 hours of Davina's. I'm just saying, you haven't made it past the 10 minute of Davina's recreation of the book or recitation, production. Point is, you've barely scratched the surface of this chapter. I'm going to need you to keep going.
Oh, no, definitely scratch this. That's like the first third, first half is their whole discussion and then their walk, their rowing. And then they've just gotten out of the boat, I believe, and they're at the mill and they're headed toward the actual buildings.
Would you say that this is like a chapter in three acts?
I think so. I think that's fair.
Because the first act is the dude died of lockjaw. The second act is...
Wait, what?
Dude died of lockjaw.
The first act is do I take the River Run or not?
Yeah, but that was... Okay, fine. But the next section is... We just found a dead slave girl. And then the next section is, we just found the guy who diddled the slave girl. Still three acts. You can pick what you think your acts are, but I think there's like three distinct sections.
There's more than three, but I definitely see those sections. Summer and I are really excited about our next sponsor. That is FabFitFun. They produce seasonal boxes full of, I mean, it's like a treasure box. What we have to share with you is that their spring 2018 box is now on presale, which means the items in the spring box are still a mystery, but I've got two spoiler items that we can share with you.
Now, spoiler item one is a clutch from Rachel Pally. It comes in three reversible colors.
Spoiler item number two is the ISH, or is it ish? Lip Statement Palette, which has 11 shades of colors and a tinted topper so you can mix and experiment with your own color combos. I just want that. You can have the clutch.
So you're gonna take my lip gloss?
So Summer and I were fortunate enough to get the winter box and oh my gosh. So what did it feel like when you got it, Sam? I got it. I think I just squealed a little bit first. I squealed. I didn't want to open it.
It felt like pre-Christmas Christmas.
I know, right? It was just before Christmas. It was like December, but not Christmas.
I hate to say it's magical, but it was kind of magical because you have no idea what's coming in this box. And you open it up. And what's great about it is I've been a member of other subscription box services in the past. And this, the difference is that for me, the biggest difference was that it had full size products, not samples. And I know I felt like with some old other subscription boxes that I just was visiting hotels and coming home with a bunch of little tiny bottles. You just got to sample, but I've got full size products, which means that you get to try them multiple times so that you really know if you like them. So that if you do want to purchase them again, you didn't just try them for one day. Cause you know, it takes a while to discover whether or not you're going to get a rash.
Now by products, just a few ideas of what we got in our winter box. Oh my goodness. Well, okay. We got a pair of socks. There was a full size Ahava mineral hand cream. There was a poncho, a beautiful reversible poncho that we both like take everywhere. A ceramic mug made by Aisha Curry. I mean, a makeup palette.
A full makeup palette.
Oh, yeah. A full-size Kate Somerville Exfolicate. Intensive exfoliating treatment. So many things. I mean, and that's not everything. I know I'm leaving like three or four things out. But you're seriously like opening it. First of all, that box is big. You're like, there's no way. Oh, and then once you take it out, at least you're never able to get everything back in because they pack it so wonderfully and it's deceiving. There is a lot of stuff in there, but once you open it and like, especially the poncho and like, you know, unravel it or whatever, it's never going back in. First of all, it's not coming off of my shoulders.
No, the boxes really are like Mary Poppins's tote bag.
I like that. And so as Summer said, it's full size products, no sample sizes, cutting edge products in every category. It's not just beauty, lots of different things.
Sign up for FabFitFun today to get your spring box. Don't wait because the FabFitFun spring box is in limited supply and these boxes always sell out. So use our code to get $10 off your first box.
Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use promo code Outlander to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 for only $39.99.
Go to FabFitFun.com and use our code Outlander to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box.
Megan P. writes, I see both Jamie and Claire's point of view about Burns. He wasn't a good man by any means, but the doctor and Claire believes all deserve small mercies. Jamie doesn't believe this, but the life he has led without her was much more difficult and full of hard truths. Claire often forgets that she isn't in her own time and that deferring to Jamie's knowledge and judgment would be best. Alas, we wouldn't love her so much without her stubborn streak. Eileen P. writes, sometimes I think Jamie has a full-time job protecting Claire from herself. Claire tends to rush in with the, I'm a doctor, making her decisions rather than seeing the full picture. Heck, even when she does see the full picture and knows the consequences, she would say, but I'm a doctor, and do it anyway. Folk notice you, Sasnak. So true. Poor Jamie must be exhausted. Jamie is ostensibly going to the mill to get Burns things for his widow. But Claire now knows he wanted to see the lay of the land, literally, before making his final decision. Diana again compares our hero's plight to Jesus's. Quote, the devil himself insisted on showing Jesus everything he was passing up. Unquote. Claire accompanies Jamie to the mill. Now, remember around the mill, there are slave huts and there are slaves in them now, and they are afraid. As Jamie and Claire enter the mill, they smelled fresh blood and they heard low groans. It's dark anyway, but just in case it's like a dangerous thing, because you smell blood, you kind of freak out like I would. In case the person who inflicted the pain, the wound, the whatever on the person were still there, Jamie was going to try and get the lay of the land again inside that little hut structure to figure out what was going on. And then Jamie calls Claire to him inside the overseer's quarters. There was a girl on a bed and she was bleeding to death. The girl says twice, I die. And when Jamie says, I think you are murdered, lass, my heart breaks. It's not often that a character is speaking to a living murder victim. That's hard to wrap your brain around it. Like, usually you show up and they're gone. All she says is, "Sergeant, tell him."
That's a deathbed promise that reeks of effort.
Oh, yeah. She can't even finish the name.
I was like, you couldn't narrow it down a little bit more. We are besieged with British officers around here. I'm sure many of them are sergeants, and a lot of them came into contact with people in and around where you are from.
As the young girl dies, Jamie says, "God will forgive you. Go in peace." Eileen P. writes, "When Jamie and Claire arrive at the mill in the pitch black, Claire notes that, quote, perhaps living all his life without even the thought of light outside after sunset had given him some sort of radar, I thought, like a bat," unquote. Cue the Batman theme. Ron Moore, what have you done?
But the presumption that he doesn't have a real job and other things to do, and he has nothing better to do than to find this quote unquote sergeant and tell him that she was murdered.
Yes. Now, what I didn't say was, it goes into more detail later on, is that while she was talking and while Jamie was holding her hand, Claire, of course, physician, is trying to figure out where the blood's coming from and all of this. And she discovers that the woman is bleeding out from her womb, from her nether bits.
Her lady parts.
Yes. She has been, at least it appears, even if it wasn't on purpose, it appears that she has been butchered. Her lady parts have been butchered. And of course, it was, as Jamie puts it, to slip a bairn. Flash to the next morning. Wow. The next day, they are back, accompanied by Farquhar Campbell. Claire confirms her opinion on the cause of death. The night before, she'd found a kitchen skewer between the girl's thighs. More than a foot long. That's long. Megan P. writes, "Whoa, I can't even begin to wrap my mind around this abortion scene. For this particular method to be common practice is just disturbing. My insides are quivering just imagining this horror."
Jamie and Claire had decided the night before to keep their opinions to themselves. Claire therefore says that she's sure the girl did it to herself. Campbell is relieved that, quote, "no one else shared in her sin," unquote. And Claire says, "what about the man who fathered the child?"
Seriously, though. Chaos monster.
No one seems to know who this woman is. They all wonder why the woman would have come to that place, to the overseer's lodge, the overseer's home, to perform that particular act or to have it performed on her. Jamie asks about the sergeant the girl has spoken of. Campbell says that there's an army sergeant in charge of the guard on the royal warehouse. Claire feigns-ish a faint, and Jamie asks Farquhar Campbell to see her outside so he can take care of the body. Campbell says that his servant will do it, but Jamie's like, "yeah, no, it's my aunt's mill and thus my concern." So while Jamie is not convinced that he wants to be the laird one day, or to cast his hands closer than one day, he will pull, "but that's my aunt," when he needs to. Fedra was there when Claire returned to the wagon after her ish faint, her fainted faint, her feigned faint. Fedra had been tasked with finding out who the person there's no presumption on who it was, or just to see if they could.
The plantation abortionist?
Yes. They didn't know. This is what I'm gathering. The reason they believed it was a slave. Well, first of all, anyone could have been in trouble for that. Man, woman, any race, right?
No. Yeah. Yes. But no white woman or man was going to assist a slave or go there at night.
No, but that wasn't a slave. She was white.
Was she?
Yeah. See, I never
gathered that from all of my I need to go read.
Summer. No. Hold on. No, it's not just you. Because I thought every single time that it was that it also was a black woman. But he says he's very careful. Diana's very careful in her words. She says servant, but she never says slave. She says servant. And then later on, when they find out the name, her name is Lissa Garver, I think. And she's a laundress.
And also when they're doing her body and doing the corpse, they talk about how white she is.
Well, yeah, but that could have just been from the pallor of death and blood loss. So wow. Okay.
But no, but that was my reaction.
Mind. Like explosion.
Now, if I'm wrong, you guys let me know, because like Summer, literally up until yesterday, I assumed, and like for the last 20 something years, and this is the book Summer read first, so since like 21 years.
Well,
I assumed she was also black. I did.
Well, because there, let's be honest, there aren't a lot of servants in this book. It's a lot of slavery. And maybe that's just bad on me for making an assumption, but I don't know, man. Though that does make the term, what was that? The blood thing. What is it called? What was the law of blood? The law of bloodshed?
Oh, yeah.
It does make the line about the law of bloodshed more applicable than I thought
exactly.
It was.
Exactly. So that, I agreed. Yeah, otherwise it would have been like, you know, it's not cool to someone have someone die, but yeah. And also for Murchison.
It's true, but it was also, but even in my memory, it was a half white baby.
A half white baby, Summer. Oh my goodness. You see the stories we make up, children?
Oh my gosh.
No, but Summer, until yesterday, no joke, it is not you. You are not alone. Okay. Summer held that for 20 years and I held that for just under 20 years. I mean, I guarantee you there'll be people who say, Ginger and Summer, you guys are silly. I knew that from day one. Well, God bless you, because I didn't. And the thing is, okay, if you're right, awesome, you know, great. If you're wrong, at least initially, then okay, you know, that's too bad, so sad, whatever. The thing is, this never comes up again. So it doesn't affect your knowing anything else about the story. It's just silly.
It was also real dark when they come across her. They never really talk about her alive.
No.
Because they never see her alive.
Exactly.
They only talk about her, about seeing her dead. And I crossed a lot of T's and dotted a lot of I's that were not T's or I's. I made a lot of L's into T's.
Diana could have given her blonde hair and there would have been no question. But she gave her brown, some kind of hair, the way she described it. It was fine, but I mean, who knows? A lot of different people can have a lot of different hair textures. So yeah, no, girl, until literally like yesterday, I was like, oh no, is she white? I was reading everything slowly and carefully. So yeah, but you're right. I think the thing that clinched it for me was the law of bloodshed, because, and that also makes sense. Again, if it were a black woman or a black person or a white person, you could have gotten in trouble. But the fact that it was a white person makes even more sense that the slave or the person ran. Cause they were afraid.
Wow. I feel dumb, y'all.
Don't, Summer. Don't feel dumb.
I'm feeling dumb right now.
This is called the book Dumbs of Autumn.
Good. Seriously. And I thought I was so on top of it when I read this book the first time and I realized it was not the first one.
Oh, Lord.
Good grief.
Okay. So
that means I've read this book more than any other book in the series.
And you still didn't know that.
And I still didn't know that.
That's true. Phaedra was there when Claire returned to the wagon after her feigned faint, and she'd been tasked with finding out who the would-be, well, not, I guess not would-be, the abortionist slash murderer was, the runaway. And she found out. All it took was a little bit of asking. It was a woman named Polly Ann, and she'd been in a hurry when she'd left her home. The only ones who might be concerned with finding out about what had happened to her would be Jamie's business. Jamie was already a part of River Run, if he wanted to be. Claire seized.
I guess I also couldn't imagine. I'm so sorry that I'm coming back to this. I guess I also couldn't imagine a slave woman, slave or freed or whatever, an African American woman coming to the, at that time of not even that, help, not them not helping a white woman, but I can't imagine a white woman approaching a slave and saying, hey, give me an abortion, or a black woman being comfortable giving said white woman an abortion. So
Well, remember, she is literally less than a year off the boat. She's brand new. Now, she knows her place, likely, and that's why she ran, because she knew she was in trouble. But I don't know how they would have done it. But she was like supposedly a midwife or someone who knew something in her, probably in her home culture as well, or in her native culture. So, yeah, I don't know.
I can't wait till this chapter is over so I can stop feeling dumb.
Okay, so let's get over it, because that is the name of this episode, Dumbs of Autumn. Because it's not just you, it's both of us.
Oh my god.
Okay.
Okay.
Claire sees to the corpse with Phaedra. The young woman appears to be in her 20s, and she's...
I can't wait to see how they pronounce that name in the show, because in my brain when I read that word, it's Phaedra.
Oh, well, it's French. And
Davina keeps saying Phaedra. But it's French, but no one there is.
She probably says Phaedra. Not with
yeah, that's how Davina says it, and I read it Phaedra.
Really? Oh.
Yes.
Well, that's because you're an English speaker who hasn't studied a lot of other things, which is fine. Not everybody.
It's what I do. It's what I do.
No.
What I do is I don't study a lot of other things. That is what I do.
Oh, Lord.
You know, okay. It's like Peter Dinklage's character in Game of Thrones. He drinks and he knows things. I don't study a lot of other things.
So the young, well, the dead woman appears to be in her 20s, and I wrote white. The book did not say she is white. Otherwise, Summer would have known it, and I would have known it. The reason
I would have, if Diana were more explicit, I'm going to blame Diana for 20 years of misdirection in this scene.
The reason for her to come to this sort of place, the mill, was because the person who would do the job could not come to her. So at least that part makes sense.
Oh my god, the more you talk about it, the more I realize I'm an idiot.
No, you're fine.
Can I come back when you're done talking about this?
No, I'm almost done. It's like this is the last line. So Claire knows to look for a slave and likely a midwife or someone who at least has those kinds of some knowledge. As Campbell drove away, Phaedra spat in the dust. A charm against evil. They'd better find Pollyann before dark because it was dangerous at night and she didn't know the woods. As I said, she was straight from Africa about a year before. Now, Phaedra wasn't helping her because she trusted or liked her. It was because she was the master's wife. So even though Jamie's not formally the master, he's seen as a master because he's white and he's related to the true mistress, the owner. Claire, as a form of ritual for the girl and her baby, scattered herbs. So she had some the stuff that she brought in the wagon when she prepped to come work on the body and everything, or prepare the body. She had brought some herbs with her to do some kind of ritual. They took the girl into the wagon and were off to find the sergeant. They returned Phaedra to River Run. Jamie changes, and Claire checks in on John Quincy Myers. Campbell had beat them, of course, and had already filled in Jocasta. So gracious, they can't stick to your own lane, dude. John Quincy Myers, this is a much needed comic relief. John Quincy Myers relays his progress to us, how he feels. Astounding fine, ma'am. I might soar around the privates, but a sweeter job of stitching I've not been privileged to see. Mr. Ulysses was kind enough to fetch me a looking glass. Never did see my own behind before. As much hair as I got back there, you'd think my daddy'd been a bear. Unquote. I love it.
I'm going to miss him when he's gone.
I hope they have an awesome. I just hope they have an awesome.
I hope they have even better than that. Oh, I seriously Hagrid? Hope that they have a. No, stop talking. I seriously hope that they have a Save John Quincy Myers campaign where they write him into the rest of the series and replace some other person that we detest at some point with that character, just so we get more of it. Because he's rich. Seriously, I love it.
He's awesome. John Quincy Myers says that his mother liked hairy men and that Indian women liked it too. Though he said it could be the novelty factor since their men didn't really grow facial or back or any body hair. I mean, it never ends with this dude.
I mean, some can, but it's...
And of course, by Indian,
not many.
Native American, but we've been through that. Once you give us a freaking tribe, we will use it. Jamie joins them. He finds out that Duncan went out on an errand with young Ian, and Jocasta is talking awfully positively about Duncan, pointedly, for someone else's benefit, it seems. Campbell is purposely avoiding eye contact. So Campbell leaves the errand Duncan had gone to find the slave woman. Campbell is not a tattletale or a, you know, he really truly does have Jocasta's best interest at heart, in mind. So before they got there, Campbell had told Jocasta what had happened at the mill, and he wants the slave woman found. He wants to save a life. He doesn't want her to be found. He wants her to be found by them, not by outsiders. Jamie and Claire then take the body into town to the Royal Warehouse. Claire asks about it, and Jamie says, well, they definitely have liquor at least, hence the guard. So more on the topic of biblical things. Claire, as doctor, feels she's lost to the dark angel by losing the woman. So lost someone to death. And it spooks her because she had been about Brianna's age. They were looking for the sergeant.
Was she, though? Everyone looked older.
Huh. Well, she guessed when she was...
Didn't she compare herself to all the people?
Back in Edinburgh, yeah. So they were looking for the sergeant. I don't know what stroke of luck or whatever. I did not write this down. I don't know if they saw him in the pub through the pub window or if someone told him where they was. But they ended up going to the sergeant at the Golden Goose where he's eating lunch. The sergeant and Jamie recognize each other. Jamie curses. Oopsie, something's not so wonderful here, I don't think. Sergeant Murchison was the name. There's bad blood there. Murchison accuses Jamie of leeching off poor widow Cameron, and Jamie says that he couldn't tell him from his brother, at which point Murchison up and leaves the tavern. But Jamie goes after him. He tells him they brought him a corpse. Now, Murchison had a brother. That's all we know right now. Murchison had a brother, and Jamie, by bringing that up, there's something that disturbs Murchison. So because he's in uniform and because he's in front of people and he, you know, and they're no longer in, well, we find out later on, they're no longer in prison. He can't lord it over Jamie with punishment, et cetera, et cetera. He can intimidate, but he can't, like, you know, beat at this moment, not yet at least. So he chooses the wise thing to do, which is to walk away. Well, Jamie's like, no, we actually have business to do. And I like what Diana wrote, that as soon as Jamie, like, had legit business and was like, look, we have a corpse. We need you to help identify if you can. And Diana, through Claire, shows us how professional Murchison could be. So once it came, you know, away from personal and into the professional, he quickly got some composure and started asking questions about the actual thing they were there to see. So that to me was, you know, like that was a point, a bonus point for Murchison in my eyes. So they want his help to help ID the corpse. Now they go over there, and when he pulled back the blanket, Murchison could not hide the look on his face.
What are the odds that the first sergeant they approach is their right sergeant? Grange. I call that a grange.
Something like that, because, yeah. And besides the fact that he had something on his face that showed that he was in shock or surprise or whatever, that there was recognition, he also just
happens to know that it was a laundress named Lissa Garver. Jimmy tells him what happened.
That should have been another giveaway. She had a last name.
Oh.
Summer.
Sorry. Oh, God. That's a lot of bleeping here, folks. Murchison says he'll take care of her and they're to go to his office to make a statement. So he says, go to my office. My secretary will, or clerk, whatever, will take a statement. Megan P. writes, the sergeant's reaction is pretty telling if you ask me. He definitely could have been the father of the aborted baby. Eileen P. writes, a ghost from Jamie's Ardsmuir past shows up in Cross Creek. Sergeant Billy Murchison, the surviving identical twin of another Ardsmuir prison guard, Bobby Murchison, who met a well-deserved tragic end. Did Jamie have a hand in Bobby's death? Quote, I'm a violent man, unquote. They get there and it's empty. Jamie tells Claire the what's for about Murchison. He'd been at Ardsmuir. He'd been sent from Ardsmuir to a company. He was in charge of the prisoners who'd been sold into indenture. But after he'd finished his job in the colonies, the Crown hadn't brought him back to Scotland or to the UK, to England, to anywhere over there. And he had had a twin, and they were always together at Ardsmuir. They had gotten away with a lot. Bobby, though, had died at Ardsmuir. Claire points out at this point that Jamie had worn his kilt to find the sergeant. That's funny. Quote, the crimson tartan might be quite literally a red flag to a bull, flaunted thus before an English soldier. Now, of course, he didn't know he was going to be there, so you cannot say for real and honestly that Jamie wore it to bug Murchison because he had no clue who it was going to be. However,
no, but it would have bugged any English soldier, and he was going to go find an English sergeant.
Yeah. So before Jamie can say whether or not he'd killed him, that is Murchison's brother, Sergeant Murchison comes in and gives Jamie a paper and pen and commands him to write it down, everything that happened. Now, the reason is that they get there and his secretary is gone, right? He's like on a break or whatever. So they wait. They're like, we're not going to go anywhere. So Murchison shows up and he's like, what? He's not there. Damn it. Okay. So you write it here. Write it right now. And Jamie, who was prideful, stubborn, and had a very hard time writing, Claire knew what was about to go down or not. Quote, there was no power on earth that would make him humiliate himself in that fashion before the sergeant, unquote. So Claire steps in and says she can do it since she was there, which I thought was a nice like middle ground. But Jamie's like, no, the Clark can wait on me at my aunt's house.
Hey.
And they leave.
Love it.
Meanwhile, Duncan has found the woman. Pollyanne. He and young Ian had spent 3 days looking for her, and they find out that it's been the woman, Lissa and her baby, or at least Lissa, that her death had been declared a murder and that they are looking for the killer, the slave, or whoever did it.
How did that go so oblong?
I don't know. It was really quick. Well, they at least had 3 days, 3 or 4 days.
I guess, but we just talked about it. Everyone agreed. It was misfortune.
It was what?
Or whatever. It was misfortune. Like, she was trying to rid herself of a babe, and it didn't work out the way she expected it to.
Oh, I see what you're saying. The death.
Yeah.
Oh. So Jamie and Claire do their thing the day after they find the body, right? So they find the body that night. They return the next morning after having reported it and clean the body, take the body into town. Or sorry, return with the body to Jocasta's and then change. And then they find out that because Campbell, that's right. So they go to get the body, they clean it, they go back to Jocasta's with the body in the wagon, and Campbell had preceded them because he left first and told Jocasta everything, including, we got to find this Pollyanne if you don't want someone else to be handling it. So then young Ian and Duncan go out with John Quincy Meyer to go find her. Meanwhile, Jamie and Claire go the same day into town, wherever that is, and confront the sergeant, blah, blah, blah. All that happens that we just went through. Young Ian, Duncan, and John Quincy Myers. I want to say John Quincy Adams so badly.
I know you do. Gosh. It's not, though.
John Quincy Myers. They were there. They were out for 3 days finding this woman. So they've arranged, now that they found her, to have John Quincy Myers take Pollyann. It'll be John Quincy Myers and Jamie. And of course, young Ian and Claire are going along too. Because...
well, he can't leave them.
Can't leave them. And Claire will not go anywhere, will not let him go without her. And they are packed up and prepped in 3 days. And that was sufficient or barely sufficient time for her to get her her outfit together. And her outfit was a set of like a brassiere and leather. Well, she had it was not just a bra, but it was a mock or makeshift brassiere and leather trousers.
Can you blame her? I can't imagine trying to ride a horse with that much fabric between me and the horse. And not only that, but without the stays, I've ridden a horse without a sports bra before and regretted it, let alone.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Let alone without, you know, the stay. Like, I can't even fathom. That would be terrible.
Jamie, when he sees her trying on the outfit, or actually, she's actually getting ready. She's going to wear it on the trip. When he sees her, he is like scandalized. It is hysterical. And he asks her, when she says, look, I had something somewhat similar to this in Boston. I wear pants all the time. And he says, you wore them outside where folk could see you? Oh, my goodness.
Why is he surprised? Brianna was on the beach in a bikini.
After he's so scandalized, they do it before they leave.
Right. And that's how we end the chapter.
Exactly. Megan P. writes, here they go again, off on a journey. Jamie's reaction to Claire wearing basically anything unconventional that doesn't cover her from neck to feet in mixed company is so funny and endearing. This was a heck of a long chapter with a lot going down and more that could still happen in result. Exciting and well written as usual. Leanne F. writes, Jamie's emotional IQ score and ability to comprehend and understand those around him are uncanny as usual. He can even speak frog in this chapter. Even without agreeing to Jocasta's decision to make him her heir, everyone at River Run naturally recognizes that the position is his. He has become a part of this place whether he wants to be or not. Those around him naturally defer to him to make decisions when Jocasta is absent throughout the chapter. Everyone, that is, except for Ulysses, who wants to keep his own familiar role in the power play, much as Dougal did back at Castle Leac. Again, Jamie is caught in the middle. More biblical echoes, temptation in Eden. Take a survey of all the worldly goods that would fall to them if they go along with Jocasta, much as was tempted by the devil in the wilderness. Quote, whither thou goest, references to Ruth, and Claire admits that Jamie is her only real temptation. And this is Leanne continuing about the chapter. Even older callbacks to River of Life as Jamie and Claire row around in the night and travel to the mill. Circle of Life and Tides with Claire's flash forwards to Brianna, wanting to divert Jamie's attention in the now of the night from deep thoughts to sensual abandonment, and then ahead again to Jamie's tombstone waiting in Scotland. The death of Lyssa, trying to slip a bairn, and the involvement of the African woman Pollyann, recently arrived, who has to go live with the Indians to be safe from Sergeant Murchison. The death of a twin brother at Ardsmuir, and enemy here and now in America. The human condition of suffering and still finding the joy in life, even knowing death lies at the end for all. Eileen P. writes, I'm reading about Claire fashioning a brassiere and designing buckskin trousers. The whole time I'm hearing the theme from Batman in my head. Jamie is scandalized by Claire in her buckskin trousers. Claire's response, quote, I've been looking at your backside in breeks every day for months, but only occasionally does the sight move me to make indecent advances on your person, unquote. Quote, actually, it's your kilt that makes me want to flee to the floor and commit ravishment, unquote. How many of you are happy Jamie can wear a kilt again? Me, me, me. Three cheers for flinging and ravishing.
Y'all, that was not only chapter 13, only 13. That was one chapter, you guys. Chapter 13. That was also the end of part 4. So join us next time when we begin part 5 entitled Strawberry Fields Forever and chapter 14.
As always, join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. Find us at outlanderpod.com/group.
And if you want to find out more about how to get involved with our DOA read-along as a contributor, please go to outlanderpod.com/DOA.
If you love our show and are entertained by it, please visit our Patreon page and consider supporting us. Every bit helps cover our costs, be it hosting, recording, equipment, etc. There are also a number of free ways to help support our show. The most important way is to help spread the word. Tell your friends and family and other Outlander fans you know about our show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.